Well, good afternoon, everybody. This is Bob Elson. We're set as usual for our Saturday afternoon show. And let's see what's on the tube and on radio today. Well, there are a lot of things, a lot of basketball. Northwestern plays against Wisconsin. And tonight, I think DePaul has their final home game of the year. They're playing at their own alumni hall against Illinois State. And, of course, as you know, DePaul is rated the number one basketball team in the country. They've lost only one game. So we have many, many things to talk about today with an old friend of ours and an outstanding sports writer, Jerry Holtzman of the Chicago Sun-Times. So we'll be talking sports with Jerry, and he'll be our guest in just about 1 minute. We're delighted on this Saturday to have as our guest an old friend of mine who was on the sports beat, the baseball beat with me for many, many years, and one of the outstanding sports writers in Chicago, in fact, in the country for my money, and a very good gin player. And that's Jerry Holtzman of the Chicago Sun-Times. Jerry, a very, very busy man, has just been showing me a collection of books called the Sports Classics Library Collection that for any sports fan, well, one of these days should be an absolute must. And some of the great books on sports, for example, Eight Men Out, The Glory of Their Times, Farewell to Sport by Paul Gallico, The Long Season by Jim Brosnan, The Paper Lion by George Pimpton, The Boys of Summer by Roger Kahn. Just offhand, Jerry, I don't know whether you're sure of this or not. Maybe I'm hitting you with a question. Which one of these books would you say was the bestseller?
Well, it's pretty tough. I'd say that probably The Boys of Summer may have been the most popular seller, but this doesn't necessarily mean that I think The Boys of Summer is the best of the 10 books. Uh-huh. But The Boys of Summer, you know, was on the New York Times bestseller list for about a year, and so they sold a lot of copies.
What about the experience of meeting some of these people? Let's take one guy who really hits me with a lot of impact, a truly great writer who's no longer with us, but he made his impact while he was here, and that's Paul Gallico. What about your visits with Paul Gallico, and how did you find, what kind of a guy was he?
Well, I saw Paul Gallico in about 1973. I visited with him for 3 days in France where he lived. I interviewed him for a different book that I was doing. And he was a very sophisticated guy. He lived in a baron. He lived in a 5-story mansion. From the outside, it looked like a very plain place, but inside it was just beautiful. He had servants. He walked around with a leather, in a velvet smoking jacket. And he was a very sophisticated and autocratic guy who was a very fine writer and who was one of the few writers who was a very large commercial success. He made a lot of money, and he knew how to use it.
What were some of the best things that Gallico did?
Well, he was a sports writer for 13 years, but he later wrote The Snow Goose, which is a very popular story, and as a matter of fact, it's usually played on television at Christmas time. His last major book was The Poseidon Adventure, which was made into a movie, where the ship turned upside down. He did a lot of books. I think he wrote about 47 books.
47 books.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What about Roger Kahn, who wrote The Boys of Summer?
Well, Roger Kahn, of course, is a very young fellow compared to Gallico. Roger Kahn is about maybe 52 or 53 years old. He was a baseball writer in New York. He traveled with the Dodgers for several years. He, too, has been a very successful writer, and he wrote The Boys of Summer about 10 or 15 years ago, and it was an extremely successful sports book.
Right from the beginning.
Right. It may have been the most successful, financially successful sports book ever written.
Is that right?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Well, I know it was successful right from the very, very start. What about The Sweet Science?
The Sweet Science was written by a man named A.J. Liebling. A.J. Liebling was a war correspondent. He was a boxing buff. He's dead. He was also... He was somewhat of a Renaissance man. He was a gourmet, and he was a great writer and a great historian. He covered the war, as a correspondent. And this book really, he was such a great boxing fan that he always went to the fights, and he did this in his spare time. And he put together, just a collection of stories about fights.
You know, Jerry, I've always been impressed when I was doing my Pump Room show, and I had a lot of famous writers and authors and movie people. I've always been of the opinion that titles contribute to the success or failure of a play or a book. I'm intrigued by this title, Eight Men Out.
Well, it's a very good title. Eight Men Out is the book. It's written by a man named Elliot Aisonoff, who, as a matter of fact, was a former baseball player. He's one of the few writers who actually was a professional ball player. And if, as a matter of fact, he managed some teams in Cuba, and many men also played for him. And he became a writer. He now writes for television. And this book, Eight Men Out, is the story of the 1919 Black Sox. This is the story of the White Sox scandal, of the only World Series that we know of that was fixed. And Elliot Aisonoff went around the country visiting all the survivors. There were eight men who were banned from baseball, you know, because of this, by Judge Landis, although they were never convicted in a court, but they never played baseball again in the major leagues. And Elliot Aisonoff took about 2 years and went around the country and saw all these, you know, all eight of these men and interviewed them. Of course, some of them wouldn't see him. But he just wrote about this entire thing, you know, his entire episode visiting with these people. And then he went back and resurrected the World Series and the trial and got the court records. And this is the definitive work of the Crooked World Series. It's a classic book.
Well, it certainly must be. Eight Men Out is the title of that one. What about The Boys of Summer by Roger Kahn?
Well, we just spoke about that. Roger Kahn wrote about his two or three years with the Dodgers in the early 50s when they were, you know, winning pennants. And this was his, this was the Dodgers as he recalled them. And then he, too, went around the country 20 years later and visited them, wherever they were living at that time. And so it was the same kind of a book. He drew on his reminiscences, and then he went around and visited everybody at the same time.
It's a great title.
The Boys of Summer, that's right. As a matter of fact, it's been aped quite a bit. You know, they're now, titles The Boys of Winter and so forth and so on, you know.
Everyone around Chicago is familiar with the name of Jim Brosnan. He used to be a pitcher for the Cubs, and he wrote a book called The Long Season.
Yes, he wrote The Long Season, I think, in 1961. It was one of the first player books. It was one of the first diary-type books where he kept a diary, a day-by-day diary of his life with the St. Louis Cardinals. And, of course, the Cardinals didn't win the pennant, but it was a very entertaining book. And what was unusual about it, not only was it among the first diary-type books, but he wrote it himself. He didn't have to have a ghostwriter. It's one of the few instances where a player or an athlete actually wrote the book himself, and it's a classic book.
Is Babe, as it indicates, the story of Babe Ruth?
Babe is the most recent book in the collection. It was published in 1974. It's the biography of Babe Ruth. Now, it is such a good biography of Babe Ruth. First of all, it's probably the best biography ever written on any sports figure. I also think it's not only the best biography written on any sports figure, it's one of the best biographies written about anybody. The writer is a man named Robert Creamer, who's a senior editor at Sports Illustrated. And he spent 5 years writing this book, researching Babe Ruth and resurrecting his life and so on. And he has a very graceful style. And I just talked to him about 2 weeks ago because he's now working on a book on Casey Stengel. And he was telling me how slow it's coming. And it's very slow. He's a very slow writer. It's a very painstaking, you know, sort of thing to do. And I told him that, well, no matter how long it takes, it's worth it because it took him 5 years to do the Babe Ruth book. And, you know, however long it takes, you know, really is, you know, is not the major concern. What the major concern is what, you know, what the finished book is like. And the Babe Ruth book is just wonderful. And I really doubt that as good as Robert Creamer is, that he can come back and match. I mean, even with Stengel, I just don't think it's possible to do a book on Stengel as good as the one he did on Babe Ruth. That's how good that book is.
Well, that's wonderful. I can recall Casey Stengel so well because he was not only a character, he was an outstanding manager. He loved baseball. I'll never forget one night. We had an afternoon game on a, oddly enough, I think it was on a Friday, and they were due to leave that night for St. Louis. So I invited him to dinner. So we went down to Bud Binion's on Plymouth Court, and he started telling me stories and we started having drinking a little bit and so on and so forth, and time is going on. I'm not conscious of it. He's catching an 11 o'clock plane. All of a sudden, somebody said, you know, we usually close. We kept this place open here till 4 o'clock because of Mr. Stengel. It was 4 o'clock in the morning, and he's supposed to be in St. Louis the next morning. So I had to get him up, and he had to take an early train. But what a visit that was.
Well, Casey Stengel is the kind of a guy that can stay out all night and be up at 7:30 in the morning, and you never know he'd been out the night before. You know, he could just go all the time. He was a wonderful man. And, you know, Casey Stengel, of course, was a very successful manager when he, when he was with the Yankees. But he had managed many, many years before that and was tremendously unsuccessful. But Casey Stengel's real success in the when you look back at it, wasn't so much of his winning championships. It was the kind of person he was. He liked everybody, and everybody liked him, and he enjoyed himself, and he was just a very nice and wonderful man.
Well, I'll buy that. He was a really one. Did you ever meet his wife? They say she was a character like he was.
Yes. In fact, I think she just passed on just recently. Oh. Right. It's too bad. But you know, she was a businesswoman all the time. He was a manager of the Yankees. She was running some kind of a business in Glendale, California, or somewhere out there.
Well, he was a director of a bank in Glendale, California, and I said to him one day when I had an interview with him, Casey, do you really work at it? He says, well, I tell you what I do. He says, I have a chair right inside the main door where people come in, and I put my feet up on the table, and people come in. They come over and shake hands. They say hello to me, and that's what his job consisted of, and that was enough.
Well, that's the kind of job you have here.
Yes, you're right. There's not too much work with it. Well, this really looks like a tremendous collection. How much time did you spend with Jim Brosnan?
Well, I've known Jim Brosnan ever since he was a player. You mean just acquiring the rights
for this book? Yeah.
Oh no, I almost no time to speak of. But I've known Jim Brosnan ever since he was a pitcher with the Cubs back almost 25 years ago when he first broke in.
Yeah.
And he's really a very good writer. I'm sorry that he hasn't written more. He should have written more than he has. He should have written maybe a half a dozen books by this time.
Well, I know that was his ambition a number of years ago. He said he was told me he was just going to sit down, settle down, and write.
Well, he has written, but I just wish he'd written. I just think it's too bad he hasn't written more.
Our guest today, and we're delighted to have him as an old friend, Jerry Holtzman, outstanding sports writer with the Chicago Sun-Times. We'll be back with our guest in just about 1 minute.
How much longer is this show?
We're delighted to have Jerry Holtzman, an old friend of mine, as our guest today. As you know, he's one of the outstanding sports writers in our town, works for a great newspaper, the Chicago Sun-Times. Jerry, a lot of people are talking about the Suter case. What do you think its impact is going to be on baseball? What is it going to be? What impact is it going to have on his teammates who may be getting $65,000 and he's getting $700,000 a year? That's one player playing a team game. Now, if he played out there by himself and pitched by himself, nobody else helping him, they'd never get him out. But he's got to have eight other players out there working with him. That's the inconsistency, in my opinion, of going for that kind of money.
Well, of course, you can't really criticize Bruce Suter. The name of the game is to get as much as you can, and he was very fortunate in the fact that an impartial arbitrator awarded him a contract of $700,000. Just to back up a bit, to understand how this happened. The Cubs offered him a salary of $350,000 a year, and he said that wasn't enough. And he was able, because of the baseball rules, because of the union rules, to appeal for arbitration. And he and his agent decided on a figure of $700,000, which was twice as much as the Cubs had offered him. The arbitrator came in, and in this situation, the arbitrator has no choice. He can either give him the $350 or the $700. He can't compromise. And so the arbitrator decided on the $700,000. I think it's a very surprising decision because, as I point out in Sunday Sun Times and tomorrow Sun Times, $350,000 is more than most of the top relief pitchers get today. And, of course, that's why the Cubs offered him that, because they didn't think they would lose the arbitration. I point out that his $700,000 salary is more than the entire salaries of the four rotation starters. Rick Rushel, Dennis Lamp, Mike Kruko, and Jim McLaughlin together are going to earn $679,000 in 1980, and Suter is going to earn $21,000 more than all the starting pitchers. The Cub pitching staff, the payroll for the Cub pitching staff is going to be $1 million. It's $1 million and some change, and Suter is going to get 70% of that. And of course, we know he's a relief pitcher, and he pitches under the late inning pressure, and it's a very tough spot. But the fact remains that he only pitched 7% of the innings pitched by Cub pitchers last year, and he's going to get 70% of the payroll. And I also acknowledge the fact that, you know, ball players are for each other, and they're always glad when one guy makes more money or, you know, whatever. They want to see everybody succeed. However, human nature being what it is, he's going to go out there and lose a few games or blow a lead for Russell or for somebody else, and it's going to be a rather delicate situation. The other question is that how is this going to affect baseball? I think it will have an effect across the board because the owners are very disappointed and surprised that he won this arbitration, and they're now in negotiations with the players. You know, and I think it will make the owners take a. Of course, they've already taken a hard line position. It'll just stiffen their resolve, so to speak, and I think increase the possibility of a strike.
That's very, very interesting, Jerry. The Cubs haven't helped themselves, at least on the face of it. The White Sox haven't helped themselves, at least on the face of it. We've had January, February, now we're going into March, and nothing has happened. How can Vec on the south side and Kennedy on the north side afford in these months, when you can create interest in baseball and in your team, afford just to sit still?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's a tough question to answer, but I think one of the ways you have to look at it is this way. The White Sox have four potentially outstanding left-handed starting pitchers. They have been offering three of the four, maybe all four, in trades, say, up until about a month ago. The offers that they got back for these pitchers, they felt that the players they would, you know, that they could get just weren't as good as the pitchers they'd be giving up. And so if you can't improve your ball club, why take a chance to make a trade? You should only make a trade when you feel that you're going to improve yourself and get a player or players better than the ones you're giving away. And they couldn't do this. They couldn't swing a deal like this. I think the Cubs will make a deal. I think Kennedy has been a very astute dealer. He has made a lot of good trades. I think that what he really should get is a pitcher. He needs another starting pitcher. And I think that it's very likely that Jerry Martin, who was a center fielder last year, will be traded for hopefully what will be an established frontline pitcher.
What do you hear from the south side?
Well, nothing. The key to the White Sox, I think, is who's going to play shortstop for them. They say Alan Bannister is going to be their shortstop. Well, we'll have to wait and see. You know, if Alan Bannister turns out to be a star or more than adequate shortstop, I think it'll be a surprise because he hasn't really been that effective a ball player.
Well, most everybody I talk to, and I talk to a lot of people around here, are Cub fans more than Sox fans because we happen to be located on the north side. They're all talking about the Suter case and what the Suter $700,000 a year salary, what impact that's going to have on the other players. I just wonder how you measure that.
Well, you can't. And, of course, what made it even worse is that after he got the $700,000, he started complaining and said he wasn't satisfied, that he had to protect his career, and that he wanted a long-term five-year contract for $700,000 a year. So, it kind of made you feel like he wasn't going to go out and pitch too hard because he might hurt his arm. He's got to protect himself. Well, anyway, he's changed his tune now, and I think that everything will work out okay. But I think that a lot of people have the feeling that, well, the Cubs can afford it. You know, what's $700,000? Wrigley has a lot of money. But I don't feel that way about it. I mean, everybody who says, the same people who say it's okay to get 700 grand a year, that could, I mean, so, if he got $1.5 million, they'd say okay. I mean, it's not their money. No. You know, it's always easy to spend somebody else's money. The fact is that the Cubs are in business, and what's going to happen here is that the fans will eventually pay at the gate. They'll, they've already increased their ticket prices, and they'll increase them again. And the Cubs have been really a very good organization for the fans, because the Cubs have not tried to milk the fans. The Cubs have kept down prices. They have, I think that the Cubs, more than any other big league franchise, have been, you know, has been a less, has been less commercial, so to speak, than any of the other big league clubs. And I think that that's, you know, that's a benefit to the fans.
Yeah. The very fact that they have not been induced to put in lights, they let the fans sit out there in the sunshine, which is the ideal way to watch a ball game, better than lights, is certainly, contributes to what you're saying.
Right. Mr. Wrigley was knocked. The late Mr. Wrigley was criticized a lot for not winning pennants. The Cubs haven't won a pennant since 1945. However, the Cubs have done a lot of other things for their fans that other owners haven't done. They've kept prices down. They have a nice ballpark. It's all-day baseball. You can buy it. I mean, he didn't sell all the box seats to corporations. I mean, anybody can walk up to the ticket counter, you know, the day of the game and, you know, and buy a good seat. You can't do that in a lot of ballparks. They're all sold. He didn't do that. And I think that the Cubs, in many ways, have been an admirable organization for the fans, despite the absence of a pennant.
Yes, well, I'd agree with you wholeheartedly. It never made money the main event out there.
They certainly have.
That's right. Money has never been the main event so far as the Cub management is concerned.
A lot of people were surprised at their choice, because pitchers, with one exception that I can think of, have never turned out to be good managers. Why Preston Gomez?
Well, Preston Gomez was an infielder, not a pitcher.
He never pitched at all?
No, you're just thinking of Ruben Gomez.
Well, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, no. No, Preston Gomez was an infielder, and he has a very good record as a manager. He has a very good reputation as a manager. He's managed two other big league clubs, at San Diego, where he had a very young club, and at Houston, where he had a very ordinary club. I think that Preston Gomez reminds me a lot of Al Lopez. As a matter of fact, he's a disciple of Al Lopez. They're great friends. He's a very patient man. I think that Preston Lopez is the kind of man that you and I would like to work for. He's a very considerate man, and at the same time, he's firm. He'll be tough when he has to. He's no pushover. And I look for him to get quite a bit out of that ball club.
Last year, if I recall the figure right, the Sox finished fifth, the Cubs finished fifth, and not much has happened to create new interest among the fans. Why?
Well, of course, don't forget this, Commander, that the White Sox have got those four good pitchers, and they're going to get better this year, especially pitching in Comiskey Park. You know, it's a great park to pitch in. And I would say that the Sox figure to be better just because they're a little bit older. They've got they now have a very good third baseman in Kevin Bell. There, it's a building situation, and I'll be very surprised if the Sox don't improve themselves this season. So far as that goes, I also think the Cubs will not finish fifth again.
Our guest today, and we're delighted to have him as one of our town's outstanding sports writers and an old friend, Jerry Holtzman of the Chicago Sun-Times. We'll be back with our guest in just about 1 minute. Our guest today is Jerry Holtzman of the Sun-Times, one of my favorite sports writers, and he and I had a lot of fun together on the beat. Jerry, do you think, in your opinion, can baseball avoid a strike?
Well, a strike can be avoided, but I think what's going to happen, and what I'm about to say, I'm not giving anybody any exclusive. I'm just saying what people inside baseball are pretty much acknowledging, and that is that there'll be spring training as usual. They're negotiating now on the union contract for the players and the owners, and I doubt very much that the contract will be signed, before the season opens. The owners will then say to the players, well, let's open the season, and we will observe we will honor the old contract. And the players will say no, because there is no contract. And you can honor it in one area now, but you won't honor it later. I would guess that there will be a strike when the regular season is about to open.
Jerry Holtzman, what, in your opinion, is the main bone of contention?
There are two bones of contention. The main bone of contention is the fact that players now can become free agents. They are free agents, so to speak. Unlike professional football, they become free agents after 6 years of major league service. They can then sell themselves to the highest bidder. Let's say that let's take Nolan Ryan. pitched for the California Angels, became a free agent, went to the Houston Astros and signed a multi-million-dollar contract. The first player to get a contract for $1 million a year for 4 or 5 years, at $1 million a year. Now, the California Angels lost Nolan Ryan and got no compensation back. He was not replaced in any way. The only compensation that they will get is a first-round choice in the summer draft of amateur players. Now, an amateur player, I mean, first of all, the amateur players, very few of them ever make it to the big leagues.
Yeah, the sandlot.
It's a sandlot situation. So the owners are saying, okay, we will have free agency, but we're going to change the rules, and if the Houston club signs a free agent such as Nolan Ryan, they must compensate the team he left with a player of comparable ability. Well, if that's the situation, then the Houston club is not going to sign Nolan Ryan, because they're trying to improve and strengthen their club, and if they get Nolan Ryan and give up a player of comparable ability, they're back where they started. So this will prevent any movement of the free agents. It will eliminate what is really a free agent, and there'll be no signings of any star players or almost any players at all, because the signing team has to compensate the team he left, and that's what the owners want.
I wish we had more time. I can think of about 20 other things I'd like to ask you, Jerry. We've enjoyed very much having you as a guest. Jerry Holtzman, one of the town's best sports writers with the Chicago Sun-Times, has been our guest today. Have a nice day, and now this is Bob Elson saying goodbye until next weekend at our usual time.